Okay, so glad you're back with us for another Gold Nugget segment. Our special guest today, David McIlvaney. David McIlvaney makes his debut on GoldSeek.com radio. He has, similar, I think, views as we do here on the global banking system, the fragility there, and just how, well, the financial system could be facing collapse. He's president of McIlvaney Financial Group, which is a 35-year-old precious metals brokerage company. He's been a featured speaker all around the country regarding world events. Welcome, David McIlvaney.
Thank you, Chris.
Let's begin with the fragility of empires. I think you do a great job on this topic. After all, you know, the U.S. is the largest empire in history. We don't really think of ourselves in this context, though, do we? You know, empires tend, though, to overextend and then collapse. Tell us more, please.
It's certainly something that we're not wanting to admit to the world, that we are an empire. It implies we like a different kind of power. We like influence. We like to do favors for others and then sort of leave strings attached dangling out there. You see that with the IMF. You see that with the World Bank. You see that with a lot of our foreign policy. You see that with our military bases strewn here and there. We promise security, and they deliver healthy relationships in terms of business and finance, and so there is some quid pro quo. So you're right. We are an empire, but we don't like to admit it. And you're right, just like most empires, there is a little bit of overreach at some point, and very few politicians are willing to deal with the economic issues of their day, basically take responsibility for making bad decisions. And so you usually see that show up in a currency. The currency is where you begin to see an indication of decline and really not owning decisions that have been made in terms of public policy. So the high cost ends up coming to the middle class. The high cost ends up coming to the man on the street. Doesn't necessarily know why things cost more from one year to the next, but you can, in fact, trace it back to mismanaging fiscal policies and overcommitting in terms of social programs and spending initiatives. And so we see that we are nearing the end of a long-run cycle. Does that mean we've got another 20 or 30 years? I don't know. Certainly we won't make the 400-year stretch that the Romans made.
I also think it's important that people find out where we went wrong. You know, when you think back to our earlier education, we were essentially taught that inflation is due to higher prices. And that essentially comes from the fact that the economy is overheating. We're doing so well that prices just have to go higher in order to compensate suppliers and manufacturers. Their cost of input and whatnot are increasing. They need to be compensated fairly. Well, we read von Mises, we read Hayek, and we learned, wait a minute, there is another school here of thought, the Austrian school. Do you subscribe to that viewpoint? And if so, tell us more.
I certainly have some influences from the Austrian school. I wouldn't say that I'm an investor driven by an ideology, but certainly it's wise to see where Hayek's contribution came in, von Mises's contribution came in, and many others before them. So I think what you look at in the 1860 to 1914 period is an example of why deflation is good. You had prices coming down, not going up. You had global growth. You certainly had cooperation internationally. The international monetary system worked more smoothly then, arguably than any other time in world history. There might be a 20-year stretch in the modern era that mimicked some degree of stability, but we were on an international gold standard at that point. And so your income always went a little bit further each year, which was kind of an interesting thing. That's quite the opposite in an inflationary-driven, Keynesian-driven monetary era, and that is, it takes more money to buy the same goods and services each year. It's not that the cost of those things are going up and they're an indication of great success. It's the fact that it takes more dollars to buy the same goods and services. So, you know, from the time the Federal Reserve was started in 1913, the dollar has lost roughly 96% of the value, that is, purchasing power that it has. So you have to earn a considerable amount more just to buy the same stuff. Frankly, I prefer the old mild deflation of the gold standard era, 1860 to 1914. What the government doesn't like about it is that any increase to your income, which you basically had by expanded purchasing power through a declining cost of goods and services, it can't be taxed. And lo and behold, 1913 stitches together an interesting piece into the tapestry. And it is that in 1913, not only did we create the Federal Reserve, the money printing machine, but we also created the graduated income tax. Now, all of a sudden, the money mandarins are in league or at least running in a parallel track with the folks in Washington, D.C. As you expand a budget, you can print more to do it, and it gives them the opportunity to increase your taxes every year as your income is increasing as a consequence of inflation as well. So, you know, expanded revenues for government, an expansion of government, the Leviathan grows. Chris, I'm a small government guy, so maybe this is my point of criticism or departure. I think we lost it around 1913 and have a lot to gain back. Don't know if we're going to do it, though.
I mean, we're certainly on board with you. Obviously, the Leviathan has just simply grown beyond its means. I mean, it's now trying to consume itself. And this is inevitable because I think the ontology that you outlined here, the worldview, is difficult for most people in this modern world to wrap their minds around because we were born into the system. I mean, we don't understand the fact that a deflationary environment is ultimately the best one for almost everyone involved, except for maybe a few elite top 1% of 1% maybe would prefer to see an inflationary system where the middle class is gutted. So I think your point is well made. Wanted to move on, though, to portfolio planning. Now, this is an essential tool today, I think even more so than it was in the past. You have a unique perspective on the ideal portfolio. And assuming that our audience has, let's say, $5,000 to invest, I wonder if you'd outline just what every investor needs to know here.
Well, very simple. I mean, one of the things that we start with is by saying we don't know what tomorrow holds. There are a variety of outcomes. Given the fact that we've accumulated so much debt in the system, we could very well have a deflationary collapse. We could have pressure in the bond market. We could have things that would make something like cash very important. On the other hand, we have all the machinery in place for something even beyond Weimar Germany, because we're not limited any longer by cutting down trees, turning it into paper pulp, and then actually printing digits on a piece of paper. We do it all digitally now. It's ones and zeros in the digital ether, and the ability to create debits and credits into the trillions of dollars can be done with a matter of keystrokes instantly. So, you know, where do we stand? Inflation, deflation, maybe a positive growth environment for the economy. I think we have to start with this basic assumption as an investor. We don't necessarily know how this is going to play out, and so with some degree of humility, it's worth having a variety of asset classes in play which accommodate a variety of outcomes. We like cash, we like gold, we like stocks. And there you have it. I mean, in essence, if you drew a triangle, let's say an equilateral triangle for simplicity's sake, and you had a third of your liquid assets in cash, a third of your liquid assets in precious metals, gold and silver, and a third of your assets in stocks, guess what's going to happen? Over a long period of time, you're going to find that you've got a certain number of horses pulling for you in one category more than another. Throughout the 80s and 90s, gold didn't do much. The major engine of growth in your portfolio would have been stocks. Now, Wall Street would say, if that's where you're supposed to be all in. Put 100% of your money there. The problem is you don't know what tomorrow brings, going back to our original starting point. So having a diversified portfolio to us does not mean having, you know, a mix of small, large, and mid-cap stocks, some of them value, some of them growth, with a little bit of a venture into fixed income, depending on age. That's kind of how Wall Street tends to think in those two major asset classes, fixed income and equities. We'd say paper assets, left side. Okay, and they're growth-oriented, maybe income-oriented. On the right side of the triangle, it's cash. And on the bottom of the triangle, the foundation of the triangle, it's precious metals, gold and silver. So $5,000, you could split it three ways and have roughly $1,666. Split those three ways. And I think what you've prepared for is any eventuality.
On paper, maybe it seems simplistic, but you cannot, again, underestimate the power of what you've shared with us today. And I'd like to just give a couple of illustrations. You know, it's easy, I think, to try to outthink the market. However, when we do that, we forget that we're competing against a million other of the sharpest minds out there, and our odds evaporate quickly. As you mentioned, the 20-year bear market from 1980 to, let's say, around 2000, 2001 for the yellow metal, just a barbarous relic. You'd have missed out on one of the greatest rallies, 12-year unbroken rally in the yellow metal. Similarly, if you were all in on the precious metals from the year 2000, you might have missed out on the 2009 rally into 2014 in stocks. Given that every fiat currency has eventually been destroyed by inflation, I wonder if you could tell listeners today your position on higher prices.
Inflation is the consequence. What we see in terms of price inflation is a consequence of monetary policy run amok. And you, when you overextend in the debt markets and finally can't finance your way out of a mess, then you generally see a major pickup in inflation. Will we in the future see a minor version of that? A major version of that, which would take us to superinflation and sort of double-digit monthly rates, or even hyperinflation, triple-digit monthly rates. We could see any of the above. It's a bit of a confidence game. We still have dollar reserve currency status, though that's being eroded, we do still have it. As and when we don't have that, I think our desperate position becomes more obvious and will compound on itself very quickly. Inflation is one of those things that most people consider strictly monetary issue. And what they forget is that you and I are actors in the marketplace, and we're surrounded by millions and billions of other sometimes rational actors and sometimes not rational actors. But we do choose to invest our money a certain way, to spend our money a certain way, and inflation has this deeply psychological and sociological element to it. So when you see an inflation expectation change, it really is not because a number has changed. It's because something in the mass mind has changed. And that's really difficult to call. When and how that changes, it's a matter of perception. It's a matter of connivance and conning by the powers that be that are running the printing presses. And when do they lose control in terms of, again, controlling expectations and the confidence of the mass of people out there? Controlling expectations. We look at a number of things, and I'm sure you do as well. The modeling for inflation is very different now than it was in the 1980s. Very few people would call Paul Volcker, and yet we don't use his metrics for inflation. Today's sub 2% would be over 8%, according to his model. Just looking at today's numbers and the things that they factor in to determine the current inflation rate. So what is it? Is it 2% or is it north of 8%? Well, according to the new model, there is no inflation. Meanwhile, we have families across this great country of ours who are frustrated not being able to make ends meet. They run out of money before they run out of end of month. And that's an impossibility for them. What do they do? Well, most of them put it on the credit card. The small difference that they have to make ends meet, they just put it on the credit card and hope things are brighter tomorrow. Inflation is ultimately, I think, our major issue. Deflation, I know many people are very, very concerned about this. I am as well. But you've got the world central bankers who all studied at the same universities, all read the same books, and they understand the machinery that's necessary to avoid what everyone fears in the central banking community, a period of time like the 1929 to 1937 period. They want to avoid it, and they'll do everything they can. 2002 speech from Ben Bernanke made that very clear. They will go as far as dropping money from helicopters. That is to say, they will put money in people's pockets and force them to spend it to keep the economy going and keep things rolling. Most of the machinery that they have is inherently inflationary.
I think our officials understand history. They maybe studied just a little bit more of it than we're aware. And they recognize that when the middle class, when the working classes, they see their budgets pinched. They're having difficult times. There really isn't any revolt. There won't be anyone in the streets. There won't be too much backlash or blowback until they can't put food on the table. And what I think our officials, the, as you call them, the powers that be, realize here, if we throw out about 50 million food stamp cards and we keep them, well, filled up each month, they'll continue paying their credit card debt, their student loan debt, their mortgage debt, their automobile, you know, loans. This will just keep rolling along, and eventually the ship will right itself, the economic Titanic, and everything will be fine. We'll be back to the 1980s and the 1990s. Maybe it's not going to be that easy this time. Tell us more.
Political continuity requires freebies, and this wasn't always the case. We did not see that the budget fully politicized until after World War II. So there's good things that come with universal suffrage and democratic expression. We see that. We like that. That's wonderful. But one of the things that you do when you expand the vote is you politicize the budget. Now politicians are very concerned what people think, what people feel, how people are going to vote in a midterm or every 4 years. And so the budget becomes the means by which you buy votes. Political continuity, again, requires freebies. So from pork barrel spending going to major corporations and government contracts to the 47-plus million food stamp recipients that you mentioned, you know, this is where we are today. The only way that they can ensure a political legacy and be written into the history books as a success, as a politician, is to make sure that the freebies keep flowing.
Unfortunately, the way the system is set up, the way the machinery is in place, you know, the only way to keep it greased and keep the cogs spinning is to offer more goodies to the masses. Otherwise, the day of reckoning is here, and we have to pay the bill. And it is an enormous bill, over $17 trillion. Now the national debt is, I believe, in excess of our annual GDP. If we take everything that's produced by our businesses, by John Q. Public, we owe more than we make in a year. This is problematic, to say the least. Of course, we haven't even added in the other liabilities there, such as Medicaid, Medicare, and so many other of the systems and programs in place. Some estimates show anywhere from $60 trillion to $200-plus trillion in liabilities. So at some point, they're going to have to rev up that printing press you're talking about, chop down all the trees in the forest, in the national forest, or we have to get our house in order. What's going to happen?
This is an interesting period of time because we have some transitions immediately ahead of us. We prioritize democracy over the other forms of government. That's what we've tried to export to places like the Middle East. We have certainly things that they can't put in place in a heartbeat. We have a history of the rule of law, and democracy is more functional here. Freedom, as a better expression, not just democracy, but freedom, is functional in the context of the rule of law. And yet democracy is something that ultimately erodes the freedoms that we have because, again, it's just a question of the mass number of people figuring out that they can vote for themselves largesse from the tax take. And it just ends up being a redistribution of wealth. That's essentially when democracy is in its sort of final death throes, it's because people have figured that they can vote from the public treasury, vote for themselves in interest from the public treasury.
Most Americans claim to have less than $2,000 in cash. Now, this is a disturbing figure, to say the least, but in this environment. But what about if things get worse, as many pundits are pointing to? What type of hardships will this group of Americans, keep in mind that's over 150 million of us, what will we be facing?
I think you're talking about social chaos. There's no question in my mind, if there wasn't 47,000 food stamp recipients, there'd be 47 million, there'd be 47 million rioters. I mean, we don't live in the cordial, respectful times of the sort of post-Victorian era. We live in a very brutal environment where I don't think people care about anything but themselves. And if I can't feed myself, I'm going to take what I need for myself. And where is the decorum, the general generosity that you could have expected 100 years ago today? I'm sorry. I mean, maybe this is a little bit overdone for me, but I just don't get the sense that my neighbor would do anything other than eat me. No. If it came to him being hungry and me being the food.
I would say this about the cannibals knocking at your door at the McIlvany residence. I would give them this food for thought, okay, pun intended. But we do have to remember that as students of history, this has happened many times before. People, they've just watched their wealth and livelihood eroded before their eyes, and there was really very little they could do. You know, we were just talking about the 150 million Americans who don't even have $2,000. How can they really invest in precious metals to protect against an upcoming hyperinflation? At this point, it may be too late. I would just simply make the argument, yes, jump up and down, let's get everyone off the railroad tracks, but then we're going to have to find ways to work with the 150 million people who really had very little preparation there. Finally, here are your thoughts on precious metals. After the 12-year unbroken run that we've alluded to earlier, you know, the advance halted abruptly in 2011, and it appears, though, that the worst might be behind the market. I know our listeners are all ears on your thoughts on gold.
Let's say, for instance, that it's not behind us. Let's say that we could go to $1,000. Let's say we could go to $850. You know, we're dealing with economic realities which are, in fact, mind-boggling. The fact that we have not just $1 trillion in derivatives, not just $20 trillion in derivatives, but we have hundreds of trillions, close to $250 billion in notional value of derivatives. That means there's layers upon layers upon layers of bets in the financial system. I think when you look at the world from a slightly different perspective, I don't own gold to profit. I own the gold as an insurance policy. And I think every day is a good day to be, if you're the first-time buyer, establishing an insurance policy. The last thing you really want is for your insurance policy to pay. Yeah, so that's the issue. Is you can blur what gold does in a portfolio. I think it does best as an offset to loss, an offset to volatility in the equity markets, an offset to purchasing power lost via central planners and central bankers. What I would say is we may have more downside volatility. As often as I can, as readily as I can, I'm going to continue to add to my gold position. And that means that I've done that consistently with some discipline at $300 an ounce and at $1,600 an ounce. And it doesn't matter to me that from $1,600 to $12 and change, I have a loss. That's not why I own it in the first place. As an anchor to my portfolio, I will ultimately be selling ounces and repositioning in other assets anyways. What I really care about is not the price of gold, but its purchasing power. So, for instance, when you look at the Dow and the gold and the ratio between them, today it's at 13 to 1. 1 ounce of gold will buy you basically 13 shares, if you will, of a cross-section of the Dow 30. Now, that number has been as high as 43 and as low as 6 in the last 12 years. So we've seen a retrenchment. That's right, 2 years of a retrenchment. We've gone from a 6-to-1 ratio up to 13. In price terms, nominal price terms, that represents gold going from 1,900 down to 1,200 and the stock market going from 12 to 16,000 and change. Am I interested in owning stocks today over gold? No, I don't think so, because at a 13-to-1 ratio, the stock market is still not compelling. It's lost 70% of its value in gold terms, and I think it's going to end up losing a total of about 85 or 90% of its value in gold terms. At which point, guess what? You can have my gold, and I don't care if gold is $500 an ounce or $5,000 an ounce. For me, it is a value exchange. I treat gold as money, and ultimately, when I can spend that money on good value, I'll do so. I don't care what the price is in nominal terms, because if I'm locked into the shenanigans that are played by central bankers all over the world, where do you have grounding and perspective for what this stuff is worth. In the Weimar Republic, you remember that you had 1 ounce of silver trading for hundreds of billions of marks. You were on your way to the poorhouse unless you had foreign currency and precious metals. What you're talking about is the ultimate decline, decay, and death of a currency. We don't have anything that extreme here today, but all I'm saying is that you can't think of things in nominal terms. Think of things in terms of purchasing power. How many ounces is it going to take me to buy an acre? How many ounces is it going to take me to buy a house? How many ounces is it going to take me to buy my cross-section of the Dow? Typically, you will see, in a purely economic cycle, a 3-to-1 Dow gold ratio. I'm happy to buy gold here. I don't care what the price is. At a 13-to-1 ratio, it's compelling because I know that my purchasing power, the difference between a 13-to-1 ratio and a 3-to-1 ratio, is a major expansion in terms of my economic and financial footprint. That's a legacy, a financial legacy I want to leave for my family.
Just like a life preserver. You know, I know this is an overused, trite example, but I mean, take a look at the one guy selling life preservers on the Titanic. Up until it started to capsize, you know, he couldn't have gotten a dollar for a life preserver. Tens of millions of dollars in those last few minutes. I mean, we're facing something similar here. One of our best friends of the show here, Robert Kiyosaki, who I think agrees with you in a very down-to-earth way. He says, look, I buy gold every month. I don't care how high or how low it is, simply because I don't trust the people printing the money. I just don't trust them. I think that's so succinct, and it just captures the epistemology that we're sharing here today. David McElvaney, any other topics that I haven't covered that you'd like to leave with the listening audience?
You know, we've been in the precious metals business for 42 years. We've brokered gold and silver all over the world and are one of the largest firms to still do that today. Family-owned business. So, you know, when you mentioned me learning to talk about inflation when I was six, it's because I started traveling with my dad when I was three. I just got back from Normandy, bringing my boys back from the 70th anniversary of D-Day. They're 8 and 5. I want them to understand history. I want them to be able to speak to it. I want them to be able to ultimately fill my shoes as I filled my father's shoes in a way that serves our client base on a much broader and longer term basis than one generation can do. 42 years in the business. We love to educate. Our weekly commentary is available for free on our website at McElvaney.com. Be happy to send current DVDs that, again, just educational overviews, which we think are very, very important for gaining perspective and making wise decisions in the time that we live in.
David McElvaney, we want to wish you continued success and look forward to having you back here on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Thank you, Chris.